Okay, by way of review, and for the benefit of those who were not here Sunday morning, those of you who were here Sunday morning will be able to answer these questions, right? The book of Esther, the story of Esther, falls where in what book chronologically?
Between Ezra and Nehemiah?
Between Ezra and Nehemiah?
Between chapter 6 and 7
of Ezra. Right?
Ezra chapter 5.
Huh? Ezra chapter 5? Let me see what is you're looking at in chapter 5. I'm sorry, Tracy. I may have said that. Now, I'm not going to tell you I didn't say that, because I go back and listen to things I preach, and I think, good grief. So I'm not going to tell you I didn't say that. But actually, it's between chapter 6 and 7. So I may have said 5. I don't know. But it's actually between chapter 6 and chapter 7. Look at chapter 6:15. The temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar, the sixth year of King Darius. You may have a note there in your Bible. 516 B.C. And then when you get to chapter 7 and verse 8, you have another time stamp in the fifth month, which is the seventh year of the king, and that's King Artaxerxes. As you see, verse 1, you may have put a note out there in your margin, 458 B.C. So there's your gap of about 58 years between those two dates. And Ezra, we have in fact on that first sheet, the third year of King Ahasuerus would be 483. He began to reign in 486. So it's in between the time that is dated in Ezra 6, completion of the temple, and the date stamp in chapter 7 of Ezra's return. Now, that's a matter of just dates and figures, but from a practical standpoint, why is it good? What's the practical benefit of knowing that these events occurred there so far as the rest of the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah?
They wouldn't have been written.
There would not be that story if it were not for the book of Esther, unless God had some other plan in mind. Because the book of Esther shows the providence of God in preserving his people from a plan to annihilate them. Okay, so it becomes a very practical and important book in that regard. While the book of Esther indeed shows God's providential care, we pointed to chapter 4:14 of the book of Esther as a key verse along that line, when Mordecai is pleading with Esther to go, exhorting Esther to go to the king. And remember, he said, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And then this key phrase, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. And we'll be looking at the events in the book that point to the providence of God, things happening when they happened, and how that impacted something else down the road. And we'll be seeing that as we go through the book. But there's another purpose in the book of Esther, especially for the Jewish readers. And what was that? Right. The historical record of how the Feast of Purim came to be. The word Purim means what? Lots. And so without this story, you say, where did they get that term? Persian word. And
this story explains the background of this feast called the Feast of Purim. That's in chapter 9, verse 20 following. Okay. So we talked about five principal characters, two of which we'll see in the first chapter, and that's on your lesson for chapter 1. Who are those two we'll see in chapter 1? Xerxes or Ahasuerus and Vashti. Right. Ahasuerus is Xerxes. Okay? And Vashti. We'll be looking at those. And the other three principal characters, of course, Esther, Mordecai, and Haman. And we looked at that briefly, and we'll be looking at that as we go through the book. All right. On your sheet, page 1, down at the bottom, we began doing chapter summary. So if you'll just turn it over to page 2, we'll continue with that. We're just trying right now to kind of get a handle on the book as a whole. And it may be that it would be helpful to you if you have room in your margin. So many Bibles don't have any room in the margin. If you put some kind of notation as to what that section's about. At least it's very helpful to me when I go back and try to study these books. Okay, we're looking at chapter 2, 1 through 4. What's that say? How did you label that section? What's happened in chapter 1? Let's just go back on chapter 1. All right. The king had a big banquet, and Vashti was called, and she refused to come, right? And so she's deposed or taken off her throne. I think somebody used another word in our class, good word, but that's the idea. Okay? And so she's removed from her throne, in other words. All right. So then chapter 2, what happens then in the first part of chapter 2?
The king had beautiful young virgins brought
to
him
so he could. Okay, so they're looking for another replacement for Vashti. Had these beautiful young women, these virgins brought to him. That's right. And so that's what we find in the first four verses of chapter 2. In chapter 5 through 18, what does that record? Okay, Esther's chosen as the queen. Okay, we'll be looking at that. So she, of all of the ones that were brought before him, is the one he chose. Happenstance, you think? Or you think the hand of God's involved in this? And particularly interesting is that she's a Jewish girl. All right, and then verse 19 through... Are there indications as to whether or not Ahasuerus knew that she was Jewish? And when this deal, this plot of Haman was revealed, you know, evidently the king didn't know this, right? And so anyway, that's an interesting thing. So. In fact, in chapter 2:20, it says Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, and that's what Don was talking about. Okay, so at the let's say we got 2:5 through 18, 2:19 through 23, a very important event in the book. Mordecai what? Mordecai saves the king. Could you elaborate on that? That's a good way to put it, but could you elaborate on how he did it?
Through Esther.
Through wisdom?
Through Esther.
No, through Esther, not this time.
Yes.
Well. Told Esther. That's I'm thinking of the other thing. Okay. But what happened that... Y'all need to read my mind. I know it's hard sometimes to read a blank page, but anyway.
There's a couple guys that were going to kill the king, and he found out their plot and revealed their plan to Esther, which he told.
So there's Esther's part in it, but the part I was looking for, there was a plot against the king that he found out about. And we had, when we talked about Mordecai in our Sunday class, we had mentioned that some think that he was high up in the Persian
government already, an appointee of rank. Don't know that, but if so, that may have given him opportunity to better know about this plot that was unfolding. And so he had Esther inform the king, and these two guys were hanged. All right, that becomes very important later, okay? And it's not just the event, but the timing of the event. If the event had happened, say, after Haman's plot and after the banquets, might not have been the same results. But happening when it happened became an important part of the story.
Also, I think it's important that they wrote it down, you know, in the Chronicles. Because, you know, had they not thought it important or written it down, then later it would not have been there for the king to read.
All right, good point. Linda makes the point that the fact that they wrote it down and it made it where the king could have that researched and find out about that. Okay. And when you read about that, what Linda's talking about, chapter 6, verse 1, where the record were brought and they were read before the king. Okay. And so now in chapter 3, the first six verses, now what happens in the story?
Mordecai does not worship Haman.
Mordecai doesn't worship Haman, so? That's right. He doesn't. So?
Haman is enraged.
He's not just mad, he's real mad, isn't he? And you see his pride. And he's mad, and so what's going to happen? You can see Haman, we talked about how he's vindictive. He's going to try to do something to Mordecai because of this. But of course, it says in verse 6, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, and so he actually wanted to bring his hatred to all the Jewish people. We'll talk more about Haman and who he was when we get to chapter 3. Then in chapter 3 and verse 7 following, to the end of the chapter, how did you label that section? This is the outcome of his anger. What did he do? He's going to annihilate the Jews. He's going to wipe them out. He's going to try to destroy the Jews. Got a plan. And so he comes up with this plan, partly based on their superstitious views about the lot. But nevertheless, that's how they determined the date that it would take place. All right, and then you get to chapter 4, and the whole chapter actually. We just put it all in one line there. What happens in chapter 4? All right, he encourages Esther to intercede before the king in behalf of the people, and he had to urge her, he had to exhort her, didn't he? And so he reveals to her what's going on and urges her to go before the king. She's hesitant to go before the king. Why? Could risk her life. If you walk before the king and he hadn't invited you and he doesn't give the right sign, that's it. So, and she hadn't been called recently. So it was a risky proposition. And you see her at the end of verse 16 of chapter 4, her commitment to this. She said, if I perish, I perish. I'm going to do this. If I die, I'll die. I'll die in a good cause, but if I perish, I perish. You see something about the character of this young woman. All right, in the first part of chapter 5, what happens? First three verses.
She goes before the king.
She goes before the king, and he receives her, doesn't he? She's
She's received favorably before the king. And ask her what's troubling her. In chapter 5, verse 4 through 8, what happened? Come to the banquet. It's the first banquet, right? There's two banquets that she had. It's the first one. And when she got to the first banquet, she asked the king asked her what her request was. Well, come to the second one. I'm going to do another one. I want you to come to that one. Okay, so in verse 9 through 14, what's that section about? Haman in his pride is determined to hang Mordecai, has a gallows made. Again, you see that playing into the stories you see a little bit later. All right, so while all this is going on, the king can't sleep. What if the king had had a good night's rest? What if this hadn't been written down, like Linda mentioned? What if this had happened some other time besides this particular night? You know, you have all these things that just seem to happen at a certain time. And so it was written in the Chronicles about Mordecai and how he had saved his life. And so I just put the king exalts Mordecai and Haman's fall is predicted. I don't know how you did chapter 6. There's a number of ways in which you could write that. But Mordecai is exalted and Haman's fall is predicted. It's interesting that even his wife and his friends predicted his fall if he began to find disfavor before Mordecai.
I love that verse. What his wife tells him.
Yeah. Yeah, Mordecai, before you've begun to fall, is of Jewish origin. You will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. That's interesting. I don't know how much she knew about the Jews. But this is an interesting statement, like Sally says. In chapter 7, first six verses, what happens?
Queen's banquet.
And what happened at this second banquet? Very important event. Okay, Haman's plot is revealed, and Esther pleads for her life and the life of her people. Good. So now she tells the king about what's going on, and that involves her people, and includes herself, my people. Okay, and so the king, of course, is full of rage. And then verse 7, through the end of the chapter, what happens? What?
They
hang Haman on what?
His own gallows.
His own gallows. That's right, the ones he made for Mordecai. All right. Now, so when in Persia, when the king made a law, what was one of the characteristics of that law?
Can't change it.
Law's been made, you can't change it. So what are you going to do? Now, he found out that this involved the queen and her people. So, in chapter 8, what is this section about? What? Okay, you're ahead of me. Chapter 8. Jews are given the authority to defend themselves, aren't they? So they make another law, okay, they can't change that first one, but they're given the power. Oh, I see where you're talking about probably. I'm sorry, Betty, at the end of the chapter, aren't you?
Verse 15?
Is that what you're talking about, verse 15?
Verse 2. Mordecai was set over the house of Haman.
Okay. I see what you're talking about. And I'm thinking of chapter 10 where that whole chapter is about his exaltation. But that's true. And that plays into this point that There's an alternate plan, a corresponding plan that allows the Jews to defend themselves. Okay, and as Betty has noted, of course, had Mordecai not been exalted to this position, then that would have impacted the events that you read about here. Because in verse 7, King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, and then so authorized them to make this other law. And then in chapter 9, the first 19 verses, what happens? Right, the Jews killed their attackers, didn't they? Defend themselves and kill their attackers. And what happened in the last of chapter 9? Feast of Purim is established. And then chapter 10 is simple, Mordecai's exaltation. And as I told you, when we do these chapter summaries, everybody's going to write them a little differently. The only purpose of all of this is to try to get an overall view of the book, what's in each chapter, for whatever benefit that may be. So thank you for working on that, participating in that as we went through it. All right, let's start in chapter 1 now. Go back up to chapter 1 and start reading there together. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, and I don't know if you happen to look at a map, that's a large territory, over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in the citadel of Susa, if you have the King James Version, it says Shushan, the palace, same idea. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of the princes and attendants, army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. Note the group of people who are invited to this particular banquet. And you'll see it's not the common people here. And if this is indeed Xerxes, which the indications are that it is, it's known also from secular history that in the third year he was planning, wanted to attack Greece. And so he gathered those of his army and the nobles of the nation together, maybe to discuss that and maybe to plan for that. And then 4 years later that he did attack Greece and failed. And so 4 years later would bring him to his seventh year, and you see in chapter 2, verse 16, that's when Esther was chosen, and some think that the selecting of the replacement, these wise men trying to get a replacement, would help assuage his anger, and the grief, or the results that might come out of his loss, he might direct that toward these wise men. Okay, so he displayed the riches of his glory, royal glory, and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days, 6 months. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. Now, you note the different people that are mentioned in verse 5. All the people who were present in the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were hangings of fine white and violet linen held by the cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble columns, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion. That is, you didn't have to keep drinking. Understand, they did sometimes have laws that they wanted people to drink, but there was no compulsion to either drink or quit. There was no law, no compulsion. A person could do, as he said at the end of this verse, as they desired. So the king had given orders to each official of his household, as you do according to the desires.
of each person. You know, when you look at a kingdom like this, you look at the riches of this kingdom, from a worldly standpoint, everything looks lovely, doesn't it? But when you look at it from a moral standpoint and a spiritual standpoint, it's a totally different picture. And so that's true with the kingdoms of today. Just riches abundant here in this kingdom and these banquets. No knowledge of God, no concern about his will. But the fact that this king had this power and had these riches, does that mean God's out of the picture? It doesn't. Even though they don't know God's in the picture, they don't know God's behind the scenes. The story of this book is indeed that God is behind the scenes. So when you look at TV and you see the rulers of our world and their plans of government, their national plans of war, and whatever that may be, just remember that God's still in control and ruling the nations of men. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine. You know, I don't know about this term, merry with wine. The term is used in the Bible in a context in which it's not talking about drunkenness. It's used that way. But it's also used in context where it seems like the people have come under the influence of the alcoholic power of the wine and impacts them. There's some interesting passages. If you'll hold your finger here, go to the book of Ecclesiastes. And look over at chapter 10. And the book of Ecclesiastes is not about heaven. It's not about eternity. It's about living on this earth. But there's a statement, a couple statements in verse 17 and verse 19 of chapter 10. In fact, there's several here about rulers. And what's good or bad for a nation based on the rulers they have. For example, verse 16, and we're not looking at this, but woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose priests feast in the morning. In other words, he's not mature. It's all about him. It's all about satisfying his desires. He's never grown up. Pity the nation that has that kind of ruler. And then verse 17, blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility. There's just not everybody that's fit to be in positions of rule and dominion. He talks about that back in verse 7. I've seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves in the land. There's people that don't belong on the noble horse and in the throne that are, and vice versa. So he says here, blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility, and whose princes eat at the proper time, or appropriate time, for strength. And not for drunkenness. Eat for the practical purposes of nourishing themselves and preparing themselves to fulfill their responsibility and not simply for the selfish purpose of satisfying the passion for drunkenness. That will affect what kind of ruler they are. In verse 19, he said, men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. He's not saying this is good or bad. It's an observation about life and the way people live and how it impacts a nation. Look over at the book of Proverbs, however. These are words of wisdom. This is counsel of a mother, chapter 31, to a king named Lemuel. In verse 4 and 5, she's talking to her son. Verse 3, she warns him not to give his strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink. For they will drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. That's for kings.
Is there any practical application to that for those of us who will never be a secular king? I'm supposed to be reading my mind again.
Fathers,
right. Fathers, isn't he the king in his household? Won't his actions and judgments impact the entire household? Should he not then be a man of sobriety? But if he's a man given to drunkenness, if he's a man given to women, verse 3, if he's a man who can't grow up like we read in Ecclesiastes, how's that going to impact the family? And while the man's the king, the wife is the queen in the house. And the same is true with her. If she's a woman given to passion, loses her sobriety through drink or whatever it may be, how's that going to impact her kingdom, her rule? And 1 Timothy 5 does talk about the woman ruling the household. So I know this is to a mother to a son who's a king, but it sure seems to me we could take words of wisdom from this. And you look back here at the story we're studying, and when it says the king's heart was merry with wine, there's a lot more to this story we'd like to know. I'd sure like to know. Why did he want the queen to come now to show her beauty? In secular history, it said that previously in the Persian kingdom, I think it was Darius, had one of his women come in, and she was made fun of, debased, really assaulted, maybe verbally, but just really humiliated. And you take a bunch of men who are under the influence of alcohol, and here comes this pretty girl. What are they going to do? What are they going to say? Is she going to be honored? Is she going to be respected? So I don't know why. The text doesn't give us enough information. There's a statement in the Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M. It's Jewish writers. But this is from the first century on. It's not at the time this was written. Their comments say that, and you may read this in some of your commentaries, that the king wanted her to come in naked. But that's not in the Bible. That's in the Targums. And so that doesn't necessarily mean there's any truth in that. I've noticed that none of the major versions even footnote that as a possibility. So I don't know if there's any support for that other than the minds of those Jewish writers who sometimes wish to embellish their history. But nevertheless, whatever it was, I don't know what the deal was. I don't know if Queen Vashti just was a woman's liber and didn't appreciate the circumstances and said, I ain't coming. I don't know. Anybody know? Huh? God knows. Have you ever heard sermons about Vashti's modesty? Sure, if you've been around a while, like Sally and me. I'll probably preach some. But it's not there. I don't know why Vashti didn't come. Was it because she was modest, or was it because she was rebellious? I do not know. If you know, you can see it in the text, you tell me. It's interesting even now as I restudy all of this and read what I can read about it. They'll talk about how great a woman Vashti was and how she demanded respect. And all. I don't know all that. I don't know. So on the seventh day when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded these seven men, the eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. You think about this king becoming angry about this. You know, if you're... Say, guys, you're sitting in the room over, let's say you're watching TV, and you say to your wife, will you bring me a glass of water? And if she doesn't come, you get in a rage and get mad and start throwing things, or hope not. What's different about this? Why would this set this guy off like this?
Because it made him look foolish in front of him.
Yeah, he's got all this, all his root pride. He's got all these guys there, and he's commanded the queen to come in. She said, no, I ain't coming. Are you a king or not? Isn't that your wife? Do you rule your household, buddy? You know, even today, men who don't rule with an iron hand, their peers may make fun of them if they're kind and considerate. Oh, are you the boss in your house or not? And so men think that to be a man, you got to be inconsiderate and rude and be a tyrant. But nevertheless, whatever all the factors were, certainly the fact that he was her husband and she refused him, and the prominent place that she had, and the possible impact the other guys began to think on the kingdom, it certainly infuriated the king. What if, okay, just a minute, what if he'd have said, oh, okay, I wish you'd have come, but how would that impact the story of Esther? It wouldn't, would it? God uses people where they are. What if Joseph's brothers had not been jealous? You may not be reading about Jacob today, because they might have died all in the famine. And God uses wicked people for his purposes. And although this king did not act appropriately, the fact is God used him. Yes, Rod, you had a comment.
Just to build on what you said a moment ago, all this time, these weeks and months of celebration and everything are all intended to demonstrate to a lot of people that he's in control, that he's the king of Persia, and everything is as he wants to be, and look how good things are when I'm in control. And now you realize number two.
So, I mean, good point.
As well.
Especially if this was in preparation, trying to get their support for an invasion of Greece.
Yes.
Yeah, man, let's get together. You can't even control your wife, buddy. You can attack Greece? Yeah, that's a good point Rod makes.
In a different vein, it also shows women that choices they make on how others,
you're ahead of me. You're taking my stuff away. Hold on, Linda. Hold on a minute. All right, that's a good point. We're going to talk about that. But I'm thinking of another man. Maybe you can see if I can talk about it without telling you who it is, and you tell me who I'm thinking about. There's another man who was also mad. And this was a tough guy. This guy had been to war. This guy was a general. This guy led men in battle. And he's out in his anger, and he's on his way to kill a fella. Y'all already know who I'm talking about. He's on his way to kill a guy. Got all these guys with him. I mean, they're armed and ready to fight. And a woman stops them in the pathway and encourages him, don't go, this is going to be a mistake. And that, Wally has already said who it is, King David. And Abigail, remember, said, and it was her husband. And it wasn't because she was just trying to protect her husband. Killing's not wrong. Murder is. He said, you can't do this, David. What was David's reaction?
He was thankful she came.
He considered her, in fact, God sent. Isn't that interesting, the difference? Instead of, oh man, all these guys are watching. I won't be able to be king anymore if I listen to this woman. What a lesson for us as men. David was as man a man as you'll ever find in the Bible. But his pride didn't keep him from listening to a woman at this particular juncture who had some wisdom to tell him, and it didn't threaten his rule. It didn't threaten his kingship. So look at the difference in David and Ahasuerus. Who do we want to be? Do we want to be a David, or do we want to be a Xerxes? Which one? So, now we're going to move to the point Linda made, and it's a good point, and I intend to talk about this. The king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king to speak before all who knew law and justice and were close to him. So he got his wise men together, and these seven princes of Persian Media had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. Now, the fact that they're in this position does mean that what they're going to come out with is going to be a good, wise decision, right? Kind of like what comes out of Congress. It doesn't mean that. You hope so, but that not necessarily so. And so, according to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? In the presence of the king and princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Whether you think she wronged them or not, the point that Linda made is true. They could see that this woman is going, and her conduct is going to have an impact on everybody that knows about it. Is that true? Can you imagine in the common house down the street now, and the guy asks his wife to do something, and says, let me tell you something, the queen didn't have to do it. You're sure no king, buddy. Can you imagine? This is a lesson for all of us and for the women in our audience. It takes special women to be elders, wives. Because like it or not, they're in the limelight. How they dress, how they talk, their sense of priorities. You reckon people say, well, the elder's wife. Preacher's wives. Any woman in the congregation is a woman who is a woman of prominence. You may think, well, this is just me. I'm not trying to impact others. Was Vashti trying to impact all the women of the kingdom? There's no indication of that at all. But it's like throwing a rock in a pond. It ripples out, ripples out, ripples out. And our lives impact others whether we like it or not. You may not agree with these wise men that she wronged them, but the fact is the impact they knew would be felt throughout the kingdom. I guess you're going to tell me I'm out of time, aren't you? So we'll pick up with around verse 17. In our class on Sunday.